Welcome to Radio Free Albion with Tony Trigilio. My guest today is Leonard Schwartz. I'll be talking with Leonard about his newest book, If, published in 2012 by Talisman House. Welcome to Radio Free Albion. This is Tony Trigilio, and I'm talking today via Skype with Leonard Schwartz. Leonard Schwartz's most recent book is If, which was published in 2012 by Talisman House. He also is the author of At Element, which came out from Talisman House in 2011, A Message Back and Other Führers, Chax Press 2008, The Library of Seven Readings, which came out from Ugly Duckling Press in 2008, Language as Responsibility from Tinfish Editions in 2006, and many other volumes. He hosts and produces the radio program Cross Cultural Poetics and teaches at the Evergreen State College. Hi, Leonard. How are you doing?
I'm fine, Tony. Great to be with you here on Radio Free Albion.
Thanks. It's great to have you on the show. I want to talk about If, and I'm going to start with something dangerous.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, I know.
Trouble for the start. Okay.
Let's put on our crash helmets. I don't want to start. Part of me doesn't want to start a poetry interview talking about grammar, but you could see what's coming. But I really appreciate how the book, the title and the refrain, the repeated refrain of the book, it hinges on, you know, the grammatical concept, the subjunctive mood, but you do this with a real sense of mood and atmosphere.
Well, thank you, Tony, and I'll try and be as grammatical as I can in my spoken responses, since speech often is not grammatical. But yeah, I mean, I wanted in the poem to see how far I could go with that two-letter word, if, as a hinge. And of course, the if in sentence structure often leads to an if-then clause. If A is true, then B follows. But the ungrammatical aspect, I suppose, of the book is that then often doesn't follow. The if or the then that follows the if often doesn't follow. So there's an extended sequence of ifs. There are occasional conclusions, contingent as they may be themselves. There are occasional then statements that come in. But how far could one ride on the if? It's a little bit like Keats's negative capability, where you're trying to live with contradiction without resolving things into too obvious solutions or diagnoses, but at the level of grammar, as you say.
I think the connection to Keats's negative capability is really helpful in thinking about the book, thinking about, as you said, that, you know, the social contract sort of says, for language, sort of says, if A, then there has to be a then B. But the book doesn't do that, and I think that's where where poetry happens, in that spot where we're in the subjunctive, the conditional, and I think that's where we fall into a poem.
Mm-hmm. The subjunctive, the conditional, the hypothetical is a term I speak of also, as if one needed to live in that circumstance or condition in order to have to aspire in any way to the condition of truth. That propositional statements, certainly categorical statements, always simplify. And our capacity to live with if grammatically and epistemologically, and dare I even say metaphysically, as well as, of course, grammatically, are what the poem proposes, to at least hypothetically engage with.
And that is that sense of living with the if, as you put it. I mean, this is where I'm really, I knew we'd move away from grammar, as risky as that start was, you know, because the poem so much, you know, as the poem is so concerned, the book, I mean, we're talking about a book length poem, but the book is so concerned with living with that if and the impermanence that comes from living with that if.
Yeah, and I do appreciate the fact that you pointed to or wanted to ground the discussion in a discussion of grammar, because certainly we have the notion of the prison house of language, that we need to live, as Frederick Jameson puts it, we need to liberate ourselves from pre-existing structures of grammar and language in order to think new thoughts or be free of the constructs that language imposes. And of course, from, the revolution of the word, from Gertrude Stein and Eugene Jolas and others forward, there's been the argument that consciousness can only be liberated by liberating ourselves from the structures of grammar. So as a poet who sees himself aligned with those lineages, but is often told that I sound very traditional, which I just have to accept, I'm glad that that to you or to some readers, certainly for myself, the desire is to mess with grammar at some level, and to remove the sense of self-certainty that that grammatical structures can falsely create. And then only from that point of view, then, can we begin to talk about lived experience, since a poem is made out of words, as Mallarmé put it, and once those words are liberated from one grammar, they begin to create a new one, or the possibility of a new one in the aftermath.
And then they create this sense of possibilities for new ways of being. And, earlier you said, well, maybe I'll get metaphysical. And I want to get metaphysical for just a moment.
Okay.
Because I'm thinking about how, new ways of grammar, new ways of language make us see ourselves and the world differently, and the physical self too. In the book, there are these moments where I'm digging, as a reader, I'm digging so much into the if statements that it feels like the seer and the seen, the subject and object, are collapsing into each other. There's one moment where you have this image of windows and mirrors and mirrors and windows, and it almost sounds like Blake to me, without the lovely excess of Blake, because I love Blake, but it doesn't have that sense of overwhelming excess, but it does feel like it has that kind of lineage. Is that sort of an eccentric reading, or is that something you're hoping for as a poet?
No, that's really interesting. I certainly do think that if, as a statement, contains both anxiety, because one would like to have some kind of certainty, but also something ecstatic, because everything is possible at that point. When there is no diagnosis, everything is still possible. And so if has that liberating capacity. Certainly Blake, for me, it's more the marriage of heaven and hell than late Blake, but create your own system of thought or become enslaved by somebody else's, as Blake puts it in The Marriage of Heaven and Hell, seems to be a pretty crucial imperative for the poet, or for anyone working with words and concepts. And so in that sense, I can embrace the notion of imagination in Blake, for sure.
And that moment from The Marriage of Heaven and Hell, it reminds me of that. I think it's one of his Proverbs of Hell, and I'm gonna misquote or paraphrase it really badly. He says something like, what is now true was once only imagined. And I think that's another another space where your if statements can reside, in that really ecstatic and noisy place of the imagination.
Yeah, no, it's true. I mean, one of the other, I think, projects of the book, or vocabularies of the poem, is something drawn from what I'm going to call the psychogeography of the Pacific Northwest, a place I'm relatively new to, only having lived here 10 years, but nonetheless now finally attracted to. And so I did want to draw off of a particular psychogeography that I hadn't been able to name for myself before, and make it pass into language and into being in a certain way that it hadn't before. The other thing I wanted to comment on, Tony, as well, in terms of your comment or discussion of subjectivity and objectivity, is I forgot to tell you, in the previous book, at Element, I solved the problem of subjectivity and objectivity. Didn't you know that?
It seems like such an eternal problem to me that I don't even trust when it feels solved. Can you talk about the solution a bit?
Of course. I borrowed from Vanessa Place and Robert Fitterman, who coined the term subjectivity,
Oh, that's right. Yes.
Which takes subjectivity and objectivity and joins them together into a single term, subjectivity. So the conclusion is rather tragic, Tony. The solution to subjectivity and objectivity, I'm afraid, is subjectivity, that takes care of that.
So the problems of philosophy are solved with the sobbing of subjectivity.
Sadly, yes.
Yes. Well, I'm taking my feet out from the window. I'm going to come back into the room, in a few minutes, I want us to hear an excerpt from the book. But before we do that, can you talk a little bit about your choice of the couplet for If?
Yeah, it seemed to me that the couplet was quick moving enough to get energy from where I was getting it all the way over to where I wanted to get it, but from multiple sources, so that it would move quickly and allow me to be nimble in terms of thought, but substantial enough that something could be developed, that it wouldn't be just a fragment that would be without any context whatsoever. So it seems to me that in this art we practice, that the kind of crucial matter is how to figure out a structure that is going to be fragmented enough so that you don't close down the possibility of multiple motifs through a poem, but not so fragmented that every piece is received without context. That would be homogeneously. And in this case, it seemed like the couplet allowed me to be both somewhat scattered, fragmented even, and at the same time establish continuities across time and across thought.
And I think that comes across for the reader, that sense of that mix of just enough of the fragment for language to be prominent, but also that sense of the nimble energy, which I think is really important in the couplet. And for me too, the couplets always do this, but especially in a book like yours, there's that's the simple white space between couplets allows this mix of the nimble movement of the couplet with the slow down pace of reflection that I get in that white space.
Yeah. Well, thank you. No, that's very encouraging for me, because I would like to think of the poem as creating a possible space for thought at the same moment as its linguistic structure that is other than thought and is material and has this kind of space and so on. But I don't think the two things exclude one another, and therefore I'm grateful for your reading.
Well, let's hear an excerpt from the book.
Fantastic. I'm going to start reading from the very first section of If. There is a prologue, and I'll start with the prologue and then go into the first section, and then we can continue talking.
Sounds
great.
So
this is the prologue and section one from If. If we have signs without interpretation, in place of a prison, I transplant a trillium. If we have signs without interpretation, I is something extra to the flower. As we are signs without interpretation, the local line that is the moon and the express line that is the sun, since we are signs without interpretation, this or that comes to a grinding halt. One can fill in the blank oneself, a logging truck, a train, a stick of lipstick. The name wouldn't matter if this wasn't the realm of risk. Is this an ocean or individual waves? Always the same, like on the first occasion, or ever the first occasion, as Stein insists, insisting repetition does not exist. The mountain thinks in us, we know that much for sure, as forest forms in all their rain and animal fear moans, press upon the window the shade of the tree and the shadow of one's body, and the shades of those gone, making of us melting glacier and solid rock. If Mount Everything is mostly invisible, and then toweringly there, if our every triumph turns out to be a darkest hour, if the tiniest nodule of sense portends either apocalypse or joy, mountain or mouth, depending on how sense is voiced. Down the road, they live in a Buick Century. Across the street, they live in an Impala with a view. We live in our own century. It should be easier to accept having a home, neither urban, suburban, or rural, everything 15 minutes apart by a car, with its cognitive rights, signs and cemetery, grand catch and release of identity, as each being passes into the other in the hermitage of hypotheses, certain images disclosing the dyslexias of grace, so many eons spent hunting in the forest, flipped to the forefront of consciousness, news about who's way down there in the cave, zip codes, or out on the ocean, sucking a philosophy that depends upon the appearance of seabirds, of which we moderns are still the sounding boards. Tricycles, it turns out, were just a phase. The bio and biography writing out this other and much longer genesis, just as the latest wireless communication provokes a smile befitting Hermes, which a wilderness of holding patterns at the airport cannot erase, sudden dyslexia, grace. If too often things reveal their own formula, earlier than they should, and are reduced to genres, it is not yet known which god idiosyncrasy serves, but surely we prize these wiggles and wanderings, and credit must go somewhere to someone for our particular accretions. Now I think it is my turn to miss the point, yet a voice has many arms and builds us a life, even after language is pillaged of its magic and flowers no longer know our individual names. Foothills continue to give meter to the way we speak, and glaciers give it weight, thrown boulders, suggestive of the force of things, so violent, so fragile, and so forlorn that by comparison you can fit any one of our endeavors into a little pocket on an ice cube tray. Does a text ask you to identify with it or to imagine that other on its ground? Maybe my kid will explain it to me later, thanks to the clarity of speech with which she is blessed. Sometimes I drive her someplace in perfect silence, postponing our discussion on the theory of reading, uncontainable wavelet, oh, those statues of Hindu goddesses with many, many arms are no false infinite. In fact, one could be the reader holding her many books, one in each hand, passing each suggestively before her eyes, taking in its suggestion without needing to put a single of her other books down. The dance of the reader spawns more dancing arms with more charming books and miniature galaxies, new grasses flaming near the summit, undulations embedded in a rock, rugs of moss, thorns, berries, tender thefts, forest vortex, febrile mind. Here is the tree that must be the center post of the world. This is the tree that is the center post of the world. No, this is the tree that is the center post of the world. This is the tree that is the center post of the world. This, the tree that is the center post of the world. This is the tree that is the center post of the world.
That was Leonard Schwartz reading from his new book, If, on Radio Free Albion. You know, you had mentioned earlier that it took you some time to get adjusted to the psychogeography of the Pacific Northwest.
Mm.
Can you talk about that a bit, the psychogeography and maybe the adjustment too?
Sure. I did move from New York City to Olympia, Washington, where Evergreen State College is, for the job that they, for some reason, offered me here. And so that was now 10 years ago. And it has its points. Certainly one of its points is the psychogeography of the Pacific Northwest, which is so rich and so mysterious. Robin Blazer's person, he was alive here when I first came, and his book, The Holy Forest, have been very helpful for me, very crucial to me, as has actually Seattle Opera's Green Ring. They do Wagner's Ring Cycle, and they call their Wagner ring cycle the Green Ring. It just basically means they have a few Douglas fir on stage, or something that looked like Douglas fir on stage. But that's helped too in terms of a certain mythos that one suddenly begins to see and become aware of in these forests here. As I speak with you, I look out my window at a vast forest. I live in the woods now, and it's silent in some ways and speaking in other ways. I mean, I'm not in a position where I want to get explicitly mystical in some sense about it, but on the other hand, one becomes aware of things. One becomes aware of the voices of certain kinds of things that one hadn't been before. You know, maybe I can put it this way, with a somewhat far-fetched analogy. Carlo Collodi was a 19th century Italian novelist who wrote Pinocchio. We tend to think Pinocchio is some old myth. It's a 19th century Italian novel, and it begins, and this is an important thing about puppets and things and objects, it begins something like this: "Once upon a time there was a king," yell the young reader. Let me try again. "Once upon a time there was a king," yell the children. "No, children, you're wrong. Once upon a time there was a piece of wood." And certainly what we have here in the Pacific North is a lot of Pacific Northwest is a lot of wood. To try and make sense of that wood and those forests has been interesting for me. So language like nurse logs and so on suddenly begins to take on meaning in a way that it hadn't before.
And so I can see from your view, everything begins with wood. And I love that. I'm thinking of my view right now in my study in my apartment is of the brick of the neighbor's apartment building. But, you know, that's Chicago. It's very cold here. So everything kind of has to begin and end with brick to keep you warm. But it was really helpful to hear you talking about that, because I think, you know, place is so important to any artist. And I think some for poets, maybe because our antenna are out so strongly, we're sometimes I think we're wearing our nerves on the outside of our skin, that, you know, place is so, I don't think we talk about place enough.
Yeah, no, it's true. It's really crucial. I think I love that image of wearing the nerve on the outside. You know, the thing about if also is that it happened so fast to me. It's a fairly long poem, at least by my standards, a 90-page poem or so. And it mostly happened in a single summer, June, July, August 2011. I was actually going back and forth between Washington and New York a lot at that point, or Olympia, Washington, Seattle, Washington, and New York. And I think the contrast, too, between, I don't associate New York City with brick, but I do associate certainly with the built and the and the presence of the human in an overwhelming kind of way, which is what's attractive about it. And I think the contrast back and forth between, if I can call it a kind of bi-coastal life at that time, really helps bring into focus what's distinctive about the one place or the other, in this case, the Pacific Northwest. So, so I do agree, topos, location, is crucial. And not being knowledgeable about Native American mythos of the area, in which there may be all kinds of, I'm sure there are all kinds of knowledge contained there, but without access to that, here in the Pacific Northwest, one is, you know, face to face with a landscape without toponyms, without names that are going to allow us to grasp a thing. And that's particularly challenging, particularly exciting, and particularly generative of, I hope, new language.
I can see how that would be generative. It's giving you an open space physically and imaginatively, you know, to work with.
Yeah, and so many of the names are so inadequate, even if they are there. Mount Rainier, what kind of name is that for that extraordinary mountain that is most of the time invisible, hidden behind clouds, and then suddenly appears and as if right on top of one? Mount Rainier doesn't do it as a name.
I was glad you also talked about the length of time that it, you know, that it took to write if that's short, you know, the final note you have, Olympia, Seattle, New York, June, September, 2011, because it got me thinking more about my experiences as the reader. You know, it has that sense of momentum and energy that when I got to that part of the book, I thought it's only fitting that this has a kind of, it's a really reflective book, but it has a diaristic feel also. Mm. And I'm wondering, thinking about more about my experience, you know, as a reader, how would you describe, your perfect reader or your intended reader, maybe that's a better word, your intended reader for If?
Oh, wow. That's a very difficult question for me. I always feel like I'm in a kind of a vacuum. And this is, Tony, why I'm particularly grateful for your time and care and attention on the book. Is there a reader ever is, of course, a question. And, the great poet William Bronk, who I used to visit in Hudson Falls, New York, in the 90s, was said, he told me once, I just need four or five readers to continue. That's all I really need, four or five readers. I wasn't sharp enough then to ask him, well, who would those four or five readers ideally be?
Please tell me who they are. Yeah.
Can I be one? Because I was certainly, very interested in his work. But it's difficult for me to answer that question. I don't have an idealized view of the reader, obviously, since I'm in doubt always as to whether there is going to be one. But I suppose the reader I have in mind is probably someone involved in the poetry world at some level, but not necessarily, but most likely someone involved in a poetry world. I'd like to be in a conversation with other poets about what's possible in form, what's possible in language, impersonal approaches to the personal, since the poem is at some level personal, but I think impersonalizing in its structure. So, Tony, I think you're the ideal reader, basically, is what it comes down to.
Well, thank you. That's an honor. And I really like the way you put that. The ideal reader for our poems might just be someone who wants to be in a conversation about what's possible.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, let's hear another excerpt from If.
That would be a pleasure. I'm going to skip to a later section of the poem. This is section 11. And perhaps I will just go straight through section 11 and then in there. Having a child is like buying a used car. You never know what you're going to get, offers Robert Kelly, underscoring the tangibility of reincarnation, a transaction, not mere doctrine. As for the constant temptation to overstep the bounds of the accessible, even as one remains humble, every year growing ever more so, if time at any rate is more than a social construct and poetry exists as an arrangement of time, sometimes we are greater than the socius, as we measure ourselves against a star or a squid or a kumquat, not competitively, of course, what would be the point, but from playful feeling towards other entities, creatures, artifacts. If the coast is crumpled skin and salt water is a rubbing into the wound, a wave up the leg, if I am so lost in my passion, it's inconceivable to me others are not passionate. If in the caves the crystalline painted images by candlelight are said to flicker, so that one seems to tear out one's insides to feed a fox, or offer one's arm to a hungry tiger, or become the cat to which a glance is offered, offering mine back in a fantastic exchange in the oblivion of the sensual present tense. A goat in the sun, that's right. A ram at the center of the sun that knows instinctively how to lead all the sheep home to the grass. And the lava flow of trucks and ambulances, buses, motorcycles, families, isolate individuals in their private cars hurtling into our common non-being in the not-so-sensual present. And a goat in the sun with a tongue and curled lips, if a ram in the sun could tell stories to the drivers. There is so much desolation in these rural towns, so many fathers dying of cancer, so many wives soon to be widows, fearing for the future of their children, and so many children in wheelchairs, and everyone, wilting under the heat of an approximate optimism I too inadvertently propose. What is this taking of pleasure in the movement of one's limbs in a wisp of summer breeze, if not the quintessence of carnal delight? I'm a rain cloud and we can't stop talking, we all get drenched. Although false memory comes to be studied in one big shower, memory showers are constant. Literature asks us to remember events we have never experienced. Words repeatedly ask us, atomized individuals, to attest to things we have never known. The cognitive fluidity of language makes sorrows I could never have foreseen become part of our common past. Broken capillaries, unmet expectations, downed countries, more. Today, let's remember to use fire at least once and engage in big game hunting. Plenty of throat to play with means plenty of sounds to murmur or mime. If one can say with assurance one did the right thing in opening the door, if laughter is excess of meaning, demonstrating absence of meaning, if I dwell in an unwillingness to come to the point, waiting for the unknown to rise like the solar force itself, if one doesn't need to see a signature to know forms of the human prior to Homo sapien composed very different poetry on the savanna of possible forms, fired very different kinds of pop guns. What if dimorphism was more terribly pronounced and men were four times bigger than their wives? How much less intelligent would that species be overall, notwithstanding the myth of gentle giants and their ilk? More to the point, what circumstance put me on the phone the other day with a stranger, bewildered by her plight, a grieving woman who wasn't sure what was coming next? Sickness and death are premised on a notion of perpetual warfare and profit. If a guru claims a tree, asks her to rescue it from the axe, and I don't believe it, even if I like trees. If it is true that if we weren't carnivores, we would never have invented music, all I can suggest is there should be no hiding out in essences. If we identify with anything in a book, author's bio note, blurbs, maybe copyright page, all else therein generates the imaginary, not the self-identical. I said what I could to her, with the limited means afforded me by phone, without any illusion I had helped.
You've been listening to Leonard Schwartz on Radio Free Albion. His most recent book is If, which was published by Talisman House in 2012 and is available everywhere you like to buy books online, including independent sites like Small Press Distribution, spdbooks.org, and at bookstores that carry books of poetry from independent presses. You can also get to know Leonard and his work more by visiting the Talisman website, www.talismanhousepublishers.com/schwartz-if.html, schwartz-if.html. Thanks for coming on the show, Leonard. It was great talking with you.
Tony, I can only thank you again for your care and time and attention. I'm grateful.
Thanks for listening to Radio Free Albion. If you're a poet and you'd like to be on a future show, or if you just want to email me and tell me what you thought of today's show, you can get in touch with me at Radio Free Albion, that's one word, radiofreealbion@gmail.com. You can also go to the show's Twitter page, twitter.com/radiofreealbion. Thanks again for listening.